report wakes every bird. Some breathing sounds and flapping wings. Sap drips start to run, marks the shape of things to come. As my body flew through the glass, a rib gave out, a cave collapsed.
CITR 101.9 FM, this is Inkstud Show, a radio show where we talk about comics, and this week is definitely talking about Comics Week. Normally, it's interviews with comic creators, but I got some of those evil critics on the phone, so we'll see if we can change it up a little. So we're going to be talking about the best or worst, I guess mostly best comics of 08, and discussing them and seeing what we think and kind of comparing notes and yada yada. My guests this week are Tom Spurgeon, the man behind The Comics Reporter, as well as I think this year you have a book coming out, don't you, Tom?
That's what they tell me.
That's been the rumor for the last 3 years, I think. But
yeah, but that's a whole other show in and of itself, and one with a lot of me crying. So, yeah.
That would be The History of Fantagraphics, and from what I've read, I've enjoyed of it. So I look forward to it possibly coming out one day, hopefully before the apocalypse. The other person I have on the phone is Douglas Wolk. Douglas, your book, Reading Comics, as well as active reviewer for several publications, am I correct?
Yeah.
And Paul Gravett was supposed to join us, but the man's line is busy. So I don't know if we had a time confusion or not, but...
I think the first thing is we immediately make fun of Paul and insult any works that he had out this year.
He has a bunch. He does have a bunch this year. He has the Mammoth Book of Crime Comics from... I can't remember the name of the publisher. And
I can't make fun of that. I don't know if you read that, if either of you guys read that, but that was actually a good book and a mostly awful series of books.
Yeah, no, you compare that to the Mammoth Book of Zombie Comics, and you wouldn't think it was the same publisher.
No, it's pretty astonishing. I thought he did a remarkably good job. So that's no fun.
No, Paul. And the other one was the Strange Comic Ones, which I haven't actually seen. Where it's just basically a little, like, I guess, Christmas time stocking stuffer book of odd comics.
It's what we call a bathroom book.
Yes.
There we go. So, how are both of you gentlemen doing today?
Awesome.
I'm great, actually.
Excellent.
It's not so bad down here.
You're in New Mexico, right?
I am in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico, for sure.
And
I'm in Portland, Oregon, comic book heaven.
It
where
is.
Comic books go to die.
it's
a very cartoonist heavy city. It's a nice place to live that way.
You know what?
Is it still a nice place to live, Douglas? Because I always wonder about that with cities like that. It's been the nice place to live for like 10 years now.
It kind of has been. Maybe I don't get out of the house very much, but I still really enjoy it here. On the other hand, I like rain and cold.
Well, it's pretty much the same climate we have in Vancouver, and I wouldn't leave it for nothing. So it's a wonderful, wonderful city. You know what? I'm going to be horrible, and I just got an email from Paul, so I'm going to play another quick song, and then we'll start up. So I'm going to play something. I think I'm going to play something by Lucy Needsley, who had a release this year. And just so folks are wondering, the songs that I played earlier are Kites, also known as Chris Forges, and who's goes under the name CF, and Power Masters, a book that came out this year, and the other band was Wannabe Texans, which features J. Bradley Johnson, who was in the Kramer's Ergot anthology this year. So there we go. I'll be right back.
Keep me nice. and dry. My feet will kick the clouds out of the sky. Squeezed out the underworld. Glance back and lose the girl. Rising further to the air. A constellation compass to get there.
And we're back. Sorry, Lucy. I just want to get started in the show. We have Paul on the line. My number I had was missing two digits, so I apologize, Paul, for not having you on sooner. Do we have you there, Paul?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. We were trying to figure out, since you weren't around, we were going to make fun of your books, but we couldn't actually make fun of them because we really like them. So, for those who don't know, Paul Gravett has many, many books, and this year, your two books, you were on, actually just a couple months ago, talking about them, the Mammoth Book of Comics. I couldn't remember the incredibly strange, weird comics, the Leather Nun and other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the other boys there, too?
Yeah.
Tom and Douglas?
I'm still here, yeah. I'm expecting the interview to be interrupted by a phone call from the Random House publicity people objecting to the use of Lucy's song.
Oh.
Yeah.
So let's start out with, why don't you, we're talking about the best comics of 2008, and I guess we'll just start the ball rolling with, why don't you each mention something that you felt that stuck out as far as really stand out and wonderful.
I thought that Yuichi Okuyama book Travel was just fantastic. Like, that thing just kind of split my brain open. It's a 200-page silent comic book about three guys getting on a train and riding it to their destination. And it's just wonderful.
Did either of you read that one? I didn't, actually. I'm bad for most of the picture box stuff, the bigger books.
Well, yeah, I did. I'm still processing it. But it is it's very good. Let's just say that. I mean, we're kind of in the age of very good. I'm not sure if it's a great book, but it's a very good one.
Are there books that you read this year that you thought are just hands down great for sure?
Acme. I thought Chris Ware's latest issue of Acme Novelty Library.
Mm-hmm.
I thought as a standalone short story was very remarkable. I thought that they finally collected and put into one place all of Tony Fitzpatrick's Portraits of a Remembered City into a one book, three book set called The Wonder. I think that's a very remarkable work. So those two kind of stand out for me. I really like the Bill Mauldin collection as an archival work. So.
Mm. How about you, Paul?
Yeah, I enjoyed the Okuyama book. You're a bit faint. It's probably, I can't quite hear you very well.
Me? Okay, I'll turn myself up a bit.
A little bit for me, Robin.
Yep.
But I enjoyed it very much, and I liked the experience of it, reading it on a train. It's the perfect place to read it, as it is on a train.
Wow.
I'm not familiar with everything that's been mentioned here. But I must pay more attention to what Ware is doing. It's very embarrassing. But I know it's going to be good. I'm sure it's going to be good. And I just haven't actually made the commitment to reading it closely. And I will, of course. I mean, Ware is just, it's almost like it goes without saying that he's almost not in the in the chart anymore because he's so outstandingly good.
One of those guys that needs the Hall of Fame.
Ware is doing that is actually sort of taking it, his work further forward to what we've seen already.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is what has been the sort of some of the breakthrough techniques or emotional levels he's managed to reach with the new Acme? What do you think?
I think he's pulled. The interesting thing for me is I think he's pulled back some of his more. I don't want to say playful, but more experimental techniques and working more on doing more of a literary structure where he's kind of like juxtaposing two stories against each other, which I find really interesting as far as like really working on honing that already stellar storytelling style.
Yeah. All right.
But then he also did that piece in Kramer's 7, like the piece around like the life-size image of the baby, which
mm-hmm.
that was such a simple idea and so perfect and flabbergasting.
I mean, one of my top choices of the year, although it probably isn't terribly sort of super sophisticated, but it just swept me up, was this book Skim by these two Canadian-Japanese cousins, Jillian and Mariko Tamaki. And I just thought it was wonderful, and I just thought there was some very good writing in there. There was some good, you know, use of words in there, as well as some beautifully fluid artwork. And I love the way that part of my passion at the moment for is seeing how comics sort of accommodate manga outside of Japan. This is and come up with new variations on it, and not always for the, you know, for the best. But the fact is that it is manga. Just in general, the whole kind of decompression, the fact that we can have big stories and we can take time to see small things and minor, supposedly overlooked things can be given more attention. That seems to me to be a kind of Japanese influence that's come into the small press and indie press world in a major way. And I think that's one of the things that attracted me to Skim. Did you guys read Skim?
Skim was fantastic. I really think, and it's interesting because I know Tom will probably have more to say about this because you're seeing a lot of non-conventional comic writers doing comics. And this was a situation where it worked, where it was a success. And it was really like people working to their strengths. And the reason it worked is because, I mean, here's a writer and an artist who had a familiarity with each other, were able to collaborate and create this instead of sticking a writer in and throwing an artist on top of that and seeing what comes out.
You know, one thing I found what was interesting about that book is there's been so much talk about making books that appeal to a certain sort of audience that you think that Skim might appeal to, and kind of manufacturing this this effect. And then when I remember reading that, it just kind of hit me over the head that this was just an honest, organic way of doing what we've been trying. A lot of people in comics have been trying to jumpstart and maybe do artificially. And it was kind of devastating for that, I thought.
That's a very good point, I think, yeah, because in a way, it's like... It's not trying to be a minx, you know, minxy minx book. It is itself in a way.
Although she does have a minx book.
Book that never was, you know, in a way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that's an unfortunate thing with a lot of comics nowadays is that people think there's this type of market and create that type of market. And the comics that really do work success are just comics that come out from that creative outlet, from someone that wants to tell that story.
No. Yeah, they're not.
Well, I have to say, on the writer and artist collaboration front, I was really, really impressed with Omega the Unknown, the Jonathan Lethem and Carl.
Yeah,
no,
this is
Carl,
I thought,
Allen,
yeah.
Thing.
Do tell me more about that because I haven't read it, so I can't know. I want to like it, so I want to know if it's really more than just basically going back to someone's nostalgia for Steve Gerber's Omega the Unknown and doing it the way that they wished it could have been done. And is there more to it than that?
It kind of takes a couple of elements from the Gerber thing that I think just stuck with Lethem and Rusnak and then just tears off in a completely different direction. And it's just really, like, thoughtful and interesting and weird and engaging. And of all the prose writers who've started writing comics in the last few years, I think Lethem is really the one who really gets the comics thing the most, and he really turns it over to the visual as much as he can. Like the last chapter of it, I think, has 8 words in it.
Right.
Well, that's got to be.
And you know, you don't see that with a lot of star writers who are going into comics. And I was just really impressed, and I enjoyed it as a work, and I enjoyed it even more on rereading.
Do you think that's something that works because of the strengths of the creators involved as well? Like, not just Jonathan, but I mean, Farrell himself has.
Yeah, it's totally the synergy there. Like, you can get a sense of a couple of different sensibilities that are all pulling really hard in the same direction.
Yeah, even the coloring, like Paul. I don't even know how to say it.
Hornschmeyer.
Paul's, I thought the coloring was really nice on that too, and really kind of fed into a whole. And what's interesting, I think, when that book came out, and I'm dying to read it in a collection, but as a serial book,
much better that way.
Yeah, it started out. I don't know if you remember this, Douglas. It started out so beat for beat, almost like the Gerber work.
Yeah, totally.
And it was kind of terrifying at first because you're like, oh, you know, this is not going to be good at all. But then, you know, by the end, it was this other creature entirely. And I just think people are going to be pulling that one apart for a long time, to kind of figure out how it works, because it struck me as very kind of measured and deliberate in a way that I'm just not used to seeing in comics anymore, where it seems like you're trying to approximate an effect. This seemed to come from kind of a deeper place.
Well, do you think that part of it is that, in one sense, he kind of started out doing something and then partway through kind of went, this isn't what I want to do, and just changed it up completely, or...?
No, there's an afterword where Listen Rusnak talk about how, you know, they remember being struck incredibly hard as kids by the first issue when they read it,
mm-hmm.
and then there was a scene that's much later in the series that they also remembered really vividly, and those are the parts that they hung on to, and everything else they just built a totally new framework around. But yeah, the first issue is basically a cover version of the first issue of the original one. And then by the end, you've got, you know, Gary Panter coming in doing five pages, which amazed me too.
you never feel shoved in any one direction with that piece. It almost sneaks up on you when you're reading it, but all of a sudden you find yourself invested in it in a way that I thought was kind of remarkable.
And what was that saying,
I like
Paul?
That one.
Paul, I didn't get what you just said there.
Sorry?
You were just saying something right before Tom was saying something.
I don't know. Sorry, I I have anything else to add to that. I suppose I'd like to just butt in here. Just one thing. I just feel it's very interesting from an outside perspective, shall we say, that there obviously is there's a whole generation, if not more than one generation, of writers like Jonathan Meetham who took part in that Atom Smashers book, for example. I think many of them have got this enormous affection for the superhero comic. I mean, the superhero comic seems to be in this whole other way it's being re-legitimized or legitimized, whatever, is by the literary world, these kind of just generation that wants to write about them and how they touch them. I think that's an exciting thing because someone like Lisa, we need more of this, please, because we need to see the superhero as having more scope than where it's been mired in these endless complex crossovers, which I'm afraid I find, you know, I'm sure they're very good, but I just can't make the effort to penetrate them.
I love them. I can't get enough of them. I'm not kidding.
To acquire them or even just decode them all, whereas these people are coming to me are bringing in something like with some. Is it Joseph Torchio did that book called The Kryptonite Kid? Have you read that one? That's the most wonderful Superman story, which isn't a Superman story. And there are like things like It's a Bird, obviously, Steven Siegel and Teddy Christensen's book. There are just these occasional ways of re-looking at this material which gives you a feeling that yes, this is the rich stuff, that this is a genre that still has got things to say.
One book that two of you mentioned in different aspects, Bottomless Belly Button.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't I start with you, Douglas?
I just love the formal weirdness of it and the incredible ambition of it. Like, you know, Dash Shaw is still a pretty young guy, and here he is making this like amazing 800-page monolith of a book, and you can see him just kind of like pushing and pushing and pushing on every page to try to do something that hasn't been done before, and you know, storytelling techniques that haven't necessarily done before, working out his kind of visual iconography, and it's also like, you know, it's emotionally affecting too, and you don't see that kind of like crazy formalism and that kind of like pure emotional gut punch together very much, and I just really enjoyed that experience.
Now, Paul, you have some reservations, I understand.
Yeah.
With Bottomless Belly Button.
Yes, I'm sorry, I do. I mean, I think I've got the book in my hand here because I thought I better have a look at this again. It's so big. I think it's 720 pages. They don't actually number the pages. Yeah, I think Dash is great. I've just read his new thing. I've got it here as well with me, the new story in Mome. I thought it was really, really interesting, and in many ways, in a few pages, did as much, if not more. There's a few things that I have misgivings about, and they're very silly things that I probably shouldn't upset me and alienate me from the book, from feeling about the book. But, for example, I forget which character it is, but I know there's a sort of slightly kind of plain-faced, kind of Lucy-looking daughter, I think, who has a jumper with that sort of classic Charlie Brown zigzag across her. And I thought, oh, and there's the frog boy, who in one image, of course, is not a frog. And then I'm afraid the scene that really blew it for me, having read through nearly to the end, and I've actually bookmarked it here, it's a scene that to me is so damages the whole thing. There's a bit where the grandfather gives, again, I forget which character it is now, but she gives a daughter or a daughter-in-law, I think it is, this model of a lighthouse. And he says here, his father made it when he passed away. It says, I want to keep this lighthouse as a symbol of him watching over me, you know. And he spent most of his life in his studio basement carefully painting a 2-inch tall stop sign. And he gives her this lighthouse, and she trips and drops it. And I went, I just knew she was going to drop it. Right. I had to look any ahead, and it just sent to me, oh, no. So there are great things, but they're also kind of clumsy. And I'm not just mean tripping over and dropping a lighthouse. I mean scenes where you go, oh, my God, if this was in a film, you go, this is such an awful, or in a work of literature of any sort, you just go, this is not been, it's just, doesn't work. And so there are bits where I really wanted to enjoy it, and I was enjoying quite a lot of it. And the other interesting thing for me, one of the things that Shaw does a lot with, which is, I think probably seems like a new technique to many people, is a lot of this writing he puts in, like, you know, knee twitch or lines in carpet or beautiful purples when he can't obviously have a full color sort of paintbrush, whatever, to do his sunsets. And there are some clever things with that, but in fact, it's a very curious thing for a British reader who's grown up with the Beano and the Dandy, which mean nothing, of course, to you, either, probably hardly at all, why should they? But the fact is that in there was an artist called Baxendale, and there's a whole tradition in kids' comics of drawing things like smell or twitch or tremble, not just sound effects, but kind of literally, you know, words or phrases within to add to the comedy, often just saying what you can see perfectly clearly, but spelling it out. And I suppose part of what I'm saying here is that some of these innovations aren't so innovative, and that we are endlessly forgetting what comics have done. I mean, we know that Chris Ware, if you saw in that Art Out of Time book that Dan Nadell did, that fantastic book, there was some old guy from the 1910s and 20s in these Sunday pages doing things that we thought Chris Ware was doing for the first time. But
and you know Chris Ware read those.
Looked back and found someone that, once again, comics have been forgotten. And just to wrap up, I mean, I had a very interesting... There's a phrase that I had in my head, which I think Art Spiegelman said to me once when I was at a festival in Barcelona back in the 80s, it always struck me, is that comics keep repeating the same 10 minutes. I think that was just because you and I have all seen, I think, comics where you know they've not looked any further than that stuff isn't going any further forward. So I do think Dash is doing important stuff here. We're getting beyond the first 10 minutes. I think the problem really is just it's perhaps been, to my mind, slightly over exaggerated in terms of its real breakthrough quality. I think that's why I'm afraid I had misgivings. It let me down on several occasions, much as I was invested in it. And in the, I don't know, maybe I've missed some. I'd love to know whether anybody's spotted but any sort of sub level that I've missed. Because I'm quite sure probably some things I've missed here.
No, that's totally fair. And
cryptic phrase that's on the. This throne is yours soon. I'm sure you all picked up on that, did you?
No.
Did you?
No.
Did you?
Tom?
I'm not even sure what he's talking about.
At the beginning, the parents, or the grandparents, more accurately, are described as king and queen at one point. There's a kind of royal dynasty kind of suggested about the family. And the old idea, of course, of the problems being inherited by successive generations and does love work and do relationships last a lifetime and these kind of things. But anyway, so that enough of my rant. Sorry, I'll stop up. But it didn't. I still think Dash has done and is doing great work. And but I think maybe we in time we'll look back and say this is maybe it was great, but it wasn't as great as things he will do in any maybe a year or two's time, including the new Bodyworld stuff he's doing.
Well, you know, I think there are works that where you want to read that work again, and then I think there are works where you want to read the next work by an artist. And I think for a lot of people, that was what Bottomless Belly Button was. Mm. And I think it does point to some problems that we have sometimes in processing that, you know, reviewers and critics have from processing comics, and that when you have someone that is a step up in terms of ambition and a step up in terms of the formal player, the kind of overall impressive wall of formal technique that they bring to bear, that you sometimes don't connect with the other stuff, and that sometimes there's almost a guilt that you're comparing it to something that's smaller and straightforward, Alex Robinson's work or something like that, where it just doesn't even feel like the same kind of effort. Mm. And so I think that sometimes that warps the way we discuss those things. But I think that most people I've talked to, you know, have reservations about Bottomless Belly, but I don't think it was overpraised in that way.
Hmm. I mean, I loved it. I have plenty of reservations about it. I think, you know, I think it's a really flawed work, but I love it despite and maybe a little bit because of its flaws.
I thought it was funny too. I mean, it's frequently very funny, which I don't think gets a fair shake. I laughed a lot when I read that book.
Okay. But still, there were even things that I even thought the kind of the fumbling first sex and the masturbation stuff and oh dear. I mean, anyway, I won't say any more. It's just it didn't seem to me to have very much depth to it. It's a family saga either, really, I suppose. And that's really why in my review, I came out. I just contrasted it with Ordinary Victories by Manu Lassanet, and who I just think has done some wonderful stuff. And it was just you put the two next to each other and you go, well, this one's just already getting on with saying and showing and thinking about so much more, and not taking 700 pages, and really not worrying about too many formal stuff, things which frankly don't necessarily add a great deal to the experience. I felt that was a far better family saga of dysfunction and secrets.
Tell me more about The Larceny, because I actually have it sitting on my shelf and I'm waiting to read it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a second part, of course. There's actually two volumes compiling four albums from French into these in the MBM format. It's extremely good.
Yeah. On the European front, one that couple of you have on your list, and I'm sure Paul, you probably feel the same as Little Nothings by Louis Trondheim. Why do that book stick out to you? Let's start with you, Tom.
You know, I just I found that book really pleasurable on kind of a surface level. I just really liked the way it looked. It was pleasing to the eye. I thought it was frequently very funny, and I don't know that I remember what hearing right. I mean, there's kind of a debate in some circles about all of those kind of books in general. These some of the French books that they don't feel go deep enough, or they don't feel are audacious or trying to do things that haven't been done before. But you know, I enjoyed that just kind of like you enjoyed a sumptuous meal. I just liked looking at it, and I thought it was funny. I don't know. That might be the most simplistic review, but that's honestly how I felt kind of reading it, which is just
my reaction to it too. It was just a real pleasure to look at on a page by page basis.
And if I remember right, I mean, I think the original exercise was that he took that on in order to draw or to experiment with different kinds of drawing, maybe watercolors. I don't recall exactly what that is now, but
it was a blog, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the frames or panels from a blog that he then moved into print. He had kind of this weird fading technique on the blog that I liked. But yeah, I don't know.
I do it too. I think probably of Trondheim's stuff last year, I kind of more preferred that Bourbon Island thing. What was it called? The pirate thing?
Bourbon Island, yeah.
Yeah, and again, I think Trondheim produces an awful lot of work. And there's a tremendous pleasure and exuberance in what he does, and I do enjoy quite a lot of it. Although I don't think I'm waiting for him. He hasn't produced stuff Mexico. This is sort of just that level higher up. Something that's a level that's kind of more beyond just the kind of just sheer pleasure and light and sort of fun, a feast, as Tom was saying. But it didn't make me go. Didn't amaze me. And what I thought was good though about the pirate thing is it actually did have quite a lot of surprising kind of darker turns to it, and it didn't. You thought the beginning was just going to be a kind of a romp, basically, but it isn't. It certainly isn't it isn't a Pirates of the Caribbean kind of thing. It's got some quite rooted sort of historical material in it, which I didn't know about the whole sort of background of the real colony. It really grew out, of course, of the fact that Trondheim has been invited perhaps more than once to this wonderful comics festival that takes place on the island of Reunion. So he's got some reasons to go out there and do sketches. And one of the pleasures of the book, if nothing else, even regardless of the story, is just Trondheim clearly just luxuriating and enjoying sketching this beautiful vegetation and landscape and architecture. And I think it's a pleasurable book. In many ways, I think, to me, the Little Nothings, I mean, obviously it doesn't sort of disappoint on the trade description act. I mean, they're not major works. It is Little Nothings, a little kind of observations, like a kind of diary journal blog approach. I think I wish that somebody would translate it from Trondheim, although it's not officially by Trondheim, of course, is the Frantico kind of sex-obsessed blog that I think we're pretty certain it is by Trondheim. I'm pretty certain everyone knows this probably. And it's done in a different style. It's extremely funny, and it's huge. I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's about 600 pages or whatever. It's a massive book. It hasn't been put into English yet. And it's fun because one thing that Trondheim tends to do is be relatively well-behaved and not get into anything kind of raunchy or ridiculous.
He's a family man.
Or too sexy, basically, or X-rated. And so by taking on this pseudonym, he's been able to sort of express a side of which we don't usually see. And I think it's a particularly good book.
That's something, I'm just going to jump in right there and kind of jump on top of that, because Bourbon Island came out from First Second, who also published some good books this year and published some stinkers. And
some stinkers?
There's a couple of stinkers.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing I find interesting is that they, in their, you know, if you want to solicit something, nothing with pornography and nothing with outright violence in it. And I find that interesting in the fact that that can eliminate a lot of really fantastic cartooning, like, you know, I will leave it all to your own imaginations. As far as the stinkers, I'm going to, and I know Tom's going to join me on this one, is the Life Sucks.
That book was awful.
Which one is this again? Sorry,
this is the vampire story that Jessica Abel was involved with.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
And it was kind of very sitcom-y, very, I thought, just kind of facile and silly and deadly dull.
It felt like something by someone who had read a bunch of goth comics back in the 90s. Thought, hey, let's do a goth graphic novel, and it's kind of where you kind of see publishers kind of throwing this idea, hey, that might work on paper, into a comic form. And there's that, and The Prince of Persia was the other one, which I couldn't read.
Yeah,
I didn't understand.
I'm seeing this little plague of comics where you can tell that the impulse to do them was really top-down from a book publishing concern.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, you see this even more in companies. Like, First Second, obviously, knows their comics, but I'm seeing a lot of publishers publishing things like, you know, I'm holding a comics adaptation of Howard Zinn's A People's History of American Empire, which, like, who thought this was a good idea?
I actually enjoyed it. I liked it. Sorry.
Which one was this? I'm sorry, which one was this again?
Howard Zinn's History of, I can't remember the title. American Empire. I enjoyed it, but I'm also poli-sci history student right now, so that's my own fault, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right there. I mean, one of the problems also is we're having all these classics illustrated or castrated or desecrated, all these kind of various versions of Shakespeare and goodness knows what else coming out, and that's a kind of, it's an easy way for publishers who don't quite know what to do when they're entering the field of graphic novels to think, well, we know we can sell this because it's a film, or it's, and that's going to be adapted into a film. That Button character, Fitzgerald graphic novel, I thought that was quite entertainingly done, actually. But yeah, I think you're right. There's dangers of just sort of thinking you can sort of tap into manufacture a book that's going to fit a particular sort of audience. I thought I have to be honest, I'm obviously a bit of a fan of Warren Police, so I think Warren Police's artwork, I like his artwork on Life Sucks, and I did find it quite funny. I felt surely they are obviously sort of, they are meant to be satirizing the whole kind of goth culture thing, and there were some sort of slapstick moments which I thought were quite, the whole problem of having to get home before the sun rises and this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's not, maybe it's not the very top level of what First Second did.
It just seems like it wasn't a challenging book for them to do, and it wasn't a challenging book to read. It was, it felt like something that came out from Vertigo in 1995, like, you know, better or worse. Mm. Now, some more, let's talk about some more foreign editions. One, Tom, you had in your list, Blackjack.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting book, because I don't understand it. I mean, I have a fundamental disconnect from Blackjack that I just don't. I read it, and usually, even when you're reading something like that, that's, you know, comes out of, arises from a different popular culture, that you can kind of grasp the basics in order to understand, okay, well, that's, he represents this element, and so when we see that, we know that he did a good thing or a bad thing. And I'm just continually baffled by Blackjack. He just does things, I have no idea why he did them. And so it's weird, because it's a very popular piece of entertainment, and of course very kind of prettily drawn. And I've had no problem with a lot of the other works that have come out of his and kind of processing them and figuring them out. But this one is just beyond me, and I'm not sure why that is. Maybe I was hoping if I could throw it at the gentleman's feet, they could figure it out for me.
I can understand part of the problem. Maybe is that we're just figuring out whether he's a good guy or a bad guy. Basically, is that what it almost boils down to?
Yeah, or why he does, or what even the signifiers are for him to be acting good or bad?
Yeah.
You know, is it good that he does when he does something? Is that so? I don't have those same kind of signposts. And it's odd because I don't know if it just represents a corner of culture that I don't know about, or a kind of storytelling that I don't know about, and if someone from the original culture were to see an episode of Mannix, they would be similarly baffled or something. You know, if it's just some sort of genre that doesn't translate. But I find it endlessly fascinating because I just have no idea what the heck's going on there.
Douglas, you got something to say on it?
Yeah, I found myself pretty much in the same boat as you, Tom, that I found myself at sea with it. It actually seemed like way too simplistic in a lot of ways, and even dopey in a couple of ways. Like the little lisping sidekick just drove me straight up a wall.
I think a lot of people loathe her, yes.
Oh my God, make it stop. I've been reading a bunch of the other Tezuka that's coming out in translation, and some of it I get into, some of it I don't. You know, I really enjoyed Apollo's song. I've liked some of the other stuff, but this is just like cutesy, dumb, medical Robin Hood. Why is this the thing that Tezuka is loved for? And I'm still wondering that.
You're no help, Douglas.
I know.
I don't think anyone's helped each other out there.
It's interesting because, of course, I mean, one of the things that Black Jack relates to, and you start to realize, is monster. I mean, the whole kind of, in fact, you start to realize that, because the whole medical drama thing that is connected to, which I think, by the way, is one of the very, very best manga of the last year. And I can say, I think it's interesting that the whole thing of how figuring out what is Black Jack? Is he a hero or a villain? Is he just a mercenary for hire? And he seems to be mercurial and hard to figure out. And I think that's quite interesting. That's probably what makes it interesting, because he doesn't seem to be consistent. And what is the message that Tezuka's saying here? I mean, after all, Tezuka himself was qualified as a medical. He could have been a doctor and not done any comics at all. And for him also, there's a whole weird thing where he can kind of take his medical knowledge and do these really very strangely jarring images of extremely lurid sort of CSI-style close-ups of bits of the interior of our bodies and things being done, and, of course, have absurdly fantastical medical achievements carried out by Blackjack. I think it's right that we should be puzzled, but I think in actual fact we don't have the mentality that the Japanese bring very often to sort of having heroes that are maybe not so clear-cut and are more flawed. I mean, that's certainly true sort of morally. So, I thought MW, which is another sort of massive Tezuka tome that came out, not maybe last year, the year before, is an extraordinary experience too, if you're looking for kind of clear moral guidelines and a kind of, okay, we know where people fit in the sort of moral scheme of things. Tezuka plays with that a great deal.
But I'd say we totally know where Black Jack fits. He's Mr. Like, you know, chop up the rich and sew up the poor.
He has a good side to him, doesn't he, actually, Black Jack at times?
He has nothing but a good side. Like, you never see him trying to extort a lot of money from poor people. You always see him trying to get a lot of money out of rich people and pretending, you know, he does it. Like, he's like the social justice guy, and his fees are just the tool of that.
Yeah.
What would Steve Ditko think?
God.
One which I know everyone loved, but I have my own reservations with, is, and I do love it, is Art Spiegelman's Breakdowns. And my thing is one of his things.
I have reservations too, but I want to hear yours.
My reservations is that it's kind of revisionist history, where it's like, look at these experimental comics I did, but let's ignore all the other stuff I did. And it bothers me, because I have world respect for Spiegelman. I have all the Raws at home. You know, I think he's really talented, but I think there's part of it that really bothers me when he poo-poos on doing a comic about poop, you know? reprint that. Let's look at where you started and how you got to doing the Rex Morgan stuff and doing Ace Hole. Like, let's see the transition. And you weren't always making brilliant comics, you know? Let's see some failures. Let's see some false starts. Douglas, what do you think?
I loved the reprinted part of it, like the original breakdowns, and having a facsimile of it, I thought was just an amazing formal move. And I love all that material. It's the stuff that was wrapped around it, that the kind of, you know, self-deprecating auto-hagiography almost, and the way that the tone of all that stuff is stabilized, like it doesn't take anywhere near the kind of risks that you see in the reprinted stuff. It's all kind of a piece, and, you know, very technically accomplished, very formally beautiful looking, one single style that, like, he does on his computer, and he doesn't really break away from.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about the one single style there, because there's quite a lot of stylistic play and referencing in it, isn't there, really, though? I mean, it's
yeah, but it's not the, like, I'm going out on a limb here, is this really going to work? You see, with, you know,
and he's not, that's what he's really, isn't he also doing, is he's really sort of saying, well, I'm going to use all the, if not perhaps quite as much of the cut-up experimentation that's in all other things that were in the original breakdowns. He's still trying to make it consistent, using the same grid formation, and even sort of cross-referencing and using images and symbols and characters from the breakdowns in stories in his new introductory stuff to kind of relate it all and continue almost from what he was doing. And the very fact, of course, that he needed to have the postscript where he does actually show a few more of his sort of sins of youth, as it were, I think indicates that they didn't all quite work out properly in the introduction, and he realized that he needs to have a further batch of stuff at the back to fill up some more gaps. So maybe it's a slightly flawed construction approach to the book.
What do you think, Tom?
I think it's really interesting that's the one book of all the big books that came out that you're not seeing pop up on a lot of people's lists.
Yeah.
And it's a hard book to like. And I think that, I mean, that's kind of, it's kind of Spiegelman in a nutshell, and that he is this very serious formalist. He's a very cautious cartoonist, which I think is why we haven't seen a lot of that stuff from his kind of wild underground years, more of it come out. But, you know, it's kind of the split between this very serious kind of art for art's sake guy, and then you have the kind of, he has a real showman side to him. He has this kind of, you know, the cards side of him, the very much, you know, there's nobody better at presenting, there has been no one better in comics over the last several decades at presenting himself and making his, you know, making his own case.
The showman.
So to kind of do that in comics form is kind of, it adds this kind of real surrealistic level to it, in that it's kind of, he makes his case in a very, almost an odd way. And you know, I've never seen anyone, he did so many interviews for it too,
yeah,
which I also found fascinating almost from a performance standpoint.
Didn't let me do it.
Excuse me?
I didn't get to interview him.
Well, you know, I didn't either, and I felt bad asking at a certain point, because he was interviewed by seemingly just about everyone. He was everywhere for a couple of months there, and I found it more interesting as kind of a artistic presentation, a production, more than I did the work itself. Not that the work itself, the core comics aren't great comics, because they are, but you know, I had similar misgivings about some of the wraparound stuff, the Virginia Quarterly Review stuff, but yeah, what an odd release that was.
I quite like the way that he, there's a very theme where he gives his son Dashiell that kind of Jack in the Box sort of monster thing in a box, and that's interesting as it connects to that Jack and the Box kids book he did for François Mouly's Toon Books line, which is an interesting sort of, that's another way of approaching the same kind of fear and coping with fear that children have to do, and Jack in the Box being a symbol of that. That I thought was quite interesting. I think the other thing about the performance, that, I mean, Spiegelman's such a showman. He knows, he's so slick on stage. When he took part at the Comica Festival, I mean, he, on the first evening, he was in conversation with Spain and Gilbert Shelton, and I mean basically Spain and Gilbert Shelton just sort of so laid back and hadn't got things particularly prepared. And whereas Spiegelman's got the whole show worked out, he does the performance, he reads out the pounds are up there one at a time, you're inside the story, and he's giving everything. And the next evening, it was also really good. He was in conversation with Posy Simmons, and she joined him, and she sort of did the mother's part and the son's part, and they were a great sort of double act. And so Spiegelman, yeah, he's very good at presenting himself, as Tom was saying. It's certainly probably nobody better in that respect.
And that,
maybe Linda Barry, who I think is just a magnificent performer as well as a magnificent cartoonist.
Yeah, we always think of him as being in a group with Satrapi and Gaiman as kind of unparalleled speakers of that sort.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the part about the stuff with the son, and that's the part where I found really interesting, but he didn't, he kind of just kind of stopped with that, where he's talking about how, you know, the mouse kind of, that's the thing he's stuck with, and that's the thing people expect with him, and that kind of introspection didn't really move as far as I was hoping, and it kind of delves into the love of Kurtzman stuff, which I've heard lots from him, and I'm kind of more interested in just seeing, like, kind of confronting the demons, so. Another.
It was back in 2003 when Spiegelman was a guest at the Berlin Comics Festival. And by the way, one of the things that tends to happen is that if Spiegelman is invited to a comics festival, the media attention is all on him. And some of the comic artists aren't necessarily all that happy about that. That certainly was the case in the Berlin Festival. And I remember then he was telling me about, what are you going to do next? What's next after Mouse, after Shadow No Towers? And he said it's going to be a work of autobiography, and this is obviously what it was. And it's not, I mean, we all know, yes, the awkward question no one ever really wants to ask, because, I mean, this isn't as good as Mouse, is it? And we all know it isn't, basically. And I think he himself was very self-deprecating, to an extent anyway, about breakdowns and about the book, because obviously it didn't sell in 1978, and he's very nervous that it's not going to sell particularly well 30 years later, because as Tom's saying, it's a hard book to like. It's very, you know, conceptual and hard and creative and interesting, but it's not exactly going to sort of grab people and engage people emotionally in the way, obviously, that Mouse did. That's always going to be hanging over him somewhat, as he shows in the introduction, the shadow of Mouse.
I'm going to completely change topics now and talk about superhero comics.
Yay.
You got a couple on here, Douglas.
I do, and I should say the list I sent you was not my list of my absolute favorite things of the year. It was just a bunch of stuff I liked.
Okay.
But, yeah. The end of Morrison Quitely's All-Star Superman. What an absolutely nonstop pleasurable comic that was. A joy, issue by issue, page by page, panel by panel, and the way that the plot kind of extends off the end of the last one. Like, there's a plot twist I will not give away that is so nice that it doesn't actually get revealed on the page. It sort of occurs to you about half an hour after you finish the story. Mm-hmm. It was just so nicely constructed. And I guess the other thing that I loved about it is that it's one of the best superhero stories that I've read in a long time that doesn't try to sort of subvert or invert or mess with the tropes of the genre at all. It just
embraces it incredibly
well.
It just embraces it and kind of plays with it. And I think that's, to me, Grant Morrison's one of the strongest writers, obviously, in mainstream comics. And I'm waiting for him to actually really be able to do something like that again, where he can work to his strengths of being able to take apart the characters, but not in kind of a standard way that people have already done it, but kind of playing with the psyche, I guess, is the way he likes to put it or something. Tom, you got some superhero stuff?
I did. I did list some superhero stuff that I thought was kind of interesting. I don't remember what they were, though.
You've got the Uncanny X-Men within brackets.
You know what I thought was interesting about Uncanny X-Men is that and I don't think it's a good comic. It's better than most of what the superhero comics that I see. But I thought what was interesting about it is that, you know, X-Men's a big metaphor comic, and people always suggest that it's a metaphor for external circumstances like racism or something along those lines. But really, it's always a metaphor for fan identity, Whereas in the 60s, you know, they were kind of trying to be part of the culture, and then in the 70s and 80s, they're trying to be like this distinct, fabulous thing. I thought it was interesting picking up a copy or a few copies of that comic and seeing that they've kind of tweaked the metaphor once again, and they're all living in San Francisco.
Mm.
And they're kind of like, they're basically kind of like cartoonists and writers and artists community that kind of hangs, that kind of is mainstreamed into San Francisco. So you have it tweaked one more time, this kind of even tighter self-image for that particular comic book, a self-image of the kind of overall greatness, the fabulousness of being a person like the people creating the comics. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Okay, we got 5 minutes left. I want to know something you're excited about this year. Tom?
But Crumb? If we really do get the Crumb book, that could be amazing.
Genesis book?
This is the Genesis book?
Yeah.
And beyond that, I really am looking forward to the Humbug collection.
That looks beautiful.
Which would be astonishing.
Douglas?
I'm really looking forward to the David Netta Kelly, what's it called, Asterius Polyp.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't even seen it yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. People have been mumbling about it for years.
It's one of those myths, those comic myths that may come true.
Oh, it does exist. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Tom's seen it. They are sending, well, David's not doing any interviews. I don't quite know why he's being so reclusive. Do we know why?
I don't think he's done interviews in years.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to interview him. I've got all the rubber blankets. And
I've actually just got sent an advance of it. I think it's quite a different style. Quite different. If you're expecting anything like what was in Rubber Blanket, which is stuff I mean, I love that stuff. I absolutely love that. That big sort of swathes of kind of Kirby, brushy kind of monumentality and impact and shadow and whatever the rest. It's not got much of that in there. It's quite a different take, different approach. And it looks really, really interesting. I just haven't had a chance to read it yet, but it looks great.
I think you have everyone else jealous.
There's a lot this year. I mean, there's a lot. My goodness, there's a lot. I think this time next year, we're going to go, bloody hell, that was an amazing year, 2009. Because I agree, we've got Crumb. We've got a lot more, though. The Sacco, apparently, is listed into the November from Metropolitan with footnotes from Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be this 800-and-something page Tatsumi biography coming out.
It's
going to be an amazing book. And there's an awful lot more. I mean, but those are the ones, some of the ones that stand out to me immediately as being extraordinary this year. Yeah.
I have to say, just a couple toss in there. The Tatsumi book this year, Goodbye, really was one of my favorites as well. And I think I'm really, really, really excited about reading the biography. It sounds fantastic. And
the Sprott book, I forget the first name, but it's the new Seth kind of fictional.
Oh, George Sprott.
Yeah. That's been serialized like in the New York Times, was it?
Yep.
Yeah, that was his New York
That should
Times.
Be very nice. I mean, of course, it's not sort of brand new and unknown or whatever.
Yeah.
I've just got some news. I mean, maybe you've heard about this. There's a new book coming out from Carol Tyler from Fantagraphics.
The one about her dad.
Oh, You'll Never Know?
Yeah. And apparently that's going to be a trilogy.
Yeah.
I mean, that looks like a really good, big, ambitious piece of work. So
it's the work about her father's time in World War II, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
very, very
news.
Promising. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's an astonishing cartoonist.
Justin Green was in Vancouver back in May for the opening of this art show in Vancouver. And he was telling me about it. He's like, it's really going to blow you away and stuff. So
wow.
I'm excited.
Is that a show of Justin Green or a show that he was mixed up with other things? Show.
It was the crazy show. So
yeah.
Him and Spiegelman came here for the opening.
Oh, yeah. Green's so. Actually, that's coming up. Spiegelman was telling me that they're doing, I think, McSweeney's is going to do like a sort of full-size, as in actual size, reprinting of Binky Brown. Have you heard about this one?
No.
Scanning from the original artwork, which they've managed to get back from someone who got it. I don't know,
for a ridiculous
exactly.
low
and then
price.
Spiegelman's writing a new intro. It's going to come out with a kind of very, very plush, extremely plush production values, like a leatherette and Bible stuff or whatever, and that's going to be out this year. So that's a McSweeney sort of project.
It deserves it. I saw the originals during the Crazy Show. They actually had the whole story there in one room, and it was pretty crazy. A lot of penises in one room.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me today, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Yay.
It's been fun.
And I'll have links to all your various blogs for people to check out. I'm really happy that the three of you joined. You're some of the smartest folks writing in comics, so it's a nice...
Oh, go on. You say it to everybody.
No.
we're all awesome. We celebrate ourselves.
There we go. That's, you know, there's one thing in comics. Everyone's really boastful and arrogant. That's what I found.
Right.
Yeah. Sarcasm abound. Thank you so much, guys. And I look forward to whatever things you have to say online. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
That was Tom Spurgeon, Paul Gravett, and Douglas Wolk. And thank you so much for listening today, folks. We were talking about the best comics of 08. And so much more we could have talked about. But we did talk about a fair amount there. Next week, I'll be playing an interview with Jacob Covey, and the week after, I've got a whole bunch of stuff I got to sort through. John Kirschbaum, CF, so many, many, many great interviews coming up. I'm really excited about Nathan Fox, Ted Stern, who's never actually done an interview, and speaking of Rubber Blankets, he was in Rubber Blankets, so I'm excited about that one. And yeah, keep listening. Up next is Crimes and Treasons, yo.
In Rome, watching that microphone. I'm sitting in a cafe in Rome, watching that microphone. And I'm sitting in a motel in France, reading about atomic romance. The big guys on the TV said the Red Brigade just shot on my knee, and the warheads in the ocean, the missiles in the sea. Time to do some nuclear testing. Watching that microphone in a motel in France, and I'm reading about atomic romance. How do you do it? The guys on the TV said the Red Brigade just lost my knee somewhere. The warheads. Oh. In the ocean, and I'm in the pocket TV. I'm in a sunglass.